The Guardian.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, and 24/7 support. Go to squarespace.com and use the offer code Guardian to get 10% off.
The Guardian Books Podcast with Claire Armistead.
Therapy Centre, colonic irrigation, acupuncture, Chinese medicine.
Okay, now put your legs in the baby-making position for me, sweetheart.
Do you mean baby-making like having sex or actually giving birth?
You know, knees up like you're pushing baby out. Now, I'm just going to pop this tube into your bum. Open wide. It's like the dentist, isn't it? Are you all right there?
Ow, yeah.
Women don't usually mind, but it freaks the men out a bit. So, let's have a little look, shall we? Are you eating enough vegetables, my love?
Yes, I think so.
Beneath the skin of everything is something nobody can know. The job of skin is to keep it all in and never let anything show. All his life, Dave had been bald, barely a hair anywhere on his body at all, bar the bristles in his brows and one under his nose. But apart from those, Dave was as smooth as a bowling ball, hence the wig.
The winner of the 2013 Observer Cape Comica Prize, there's a mouthful, for graphic short stories has just been announced. It's the seventh year of the prize, and we're catching up with two previous winners on this podcast. With me in the studio is one of the judges of the prize, Rachel Cook. Also, Isabel Greenberg, whose first graphic novel, based on a story with which she won it in 2011, has just been published. Welcome to both of you. But first, let's turn to Rachel for the reveal. Rachel, tell us about the winner of this year's prize.
Well, I'm very pleased to say that yet again a woman has won the prize. And her name is Emily Howarth Booth, and her story is called Colonic. And it's a funny one this year. It's very funny. It's based on her own experiences in the world of alternative therapies. I probably won't say any more than that.
You did write that its protagonist spends most of her time on her back with a large tube sticking up her backside.
Yes, Emily told me when I interviewed her, when I told her that she'd won the prize, she told me that she'd been suffering from ME. In order to try and make herself better, she'd tried a whole range of therapies, one of which was colonic irrigation. And basically her story is her in the therapy room with the tube up her bottom, and the therapist is just sort of ranting at her. And it's really hilarious, I think. It's really, really funny. Everyone will enjoy it. It's brilliant.
Now, in 2007, when the very first prize was given, you wrote a slightly grudging piece saying that announcing that you had been converted to this sort of upstart art form. Mm. And here you are, you're practically granny now. You've got
older than all the winners.
they really have grown up. And Isabel, you won, as we said, 2 years ago. Tell us about the Encyclopedia of Early Earth, which is the book that has come of the short story.
It's basically the story of a storyteller on a journey across an imagined version of Earth called Early Earth. And as he travels, he tells the stories of the places that he goes. And there's all sorts of obstacles along his way, including interfering gods and mad kings. And he's basically on a quest for true love and a happy ending.
That's a really beautiful thing, isn't it, Rachel? I've got it here in front
gorgeous.
Of me. There's a picture of the central character, and he's on a sort of globe. He's an Inuit, is he, would we say?
They're all sort of invented peoples, because I didn't want to be...
Too specific.
Yeah.
Too limiting, wouldn't it?
You call him Nordman.
He's a Nord, yeah.
A Nord.
It's all... Everything is completely invented. There's absolutely no cultural appropriation, because it's all invented.
I said actually when I reviewed it that it was like Noggin the Nog reimagined by Tove Jansson, and probably Isabel's probably too young to remember Noggin the Nog, but Noggin the Nog was a sort of Viking figure but also imagined, and I think it has that quality of it makes you think of the Norse sagas but with a twist.
Yeah, I didn't want to actually write about actual Inuits because I didn't feel I knew enough. So I wanted to invent my own, like, mad tribes and different people from different worlds. Like, in all fantasy books, they have different worlds, and I wanted to write a book that could have a map with it. I haven't actually done a map because I want to do other countries in the next book. So I didn't want to limit myself with a map.
Rachel, describe it, because it's always hard on something which is in audio to actually give a sense of what it actually looks like. It's quite whimsical, isn't it?
I
said there's you've got Nord standing on a North Pole on a globe beside what looks like a little fox and a tiny miniature little igloo.
Well, the prologue of the book is actually the short story that Isabel won the competition with, and it starts with two people who are in love, but they can't touch because one is from the north and one is from the south, and the poles repel. So the way that they show their affection for each other is, for instance, they take turns to lie on the warm patch in the bed that the other one has left because they can't kiss or anything. And when you open it up, I hope Isabel won't be offended by this, but when you first look at it, it has the feeling of a picture book. But then, of course, once you start reading, you realise it's much cleverer than that. And so, I think a child could read it, but it's definitely an adult book because there are so many references. You know, it's so rich. And this is the thing I think about graphic novels in general, is that on the surface of it, you're just reading a comic or a picture book, but there are all these layers underneath, and that's why they're so magical. Mm-hmm. And that's why you can read them over and over again, because each time you might spot something new, especially in Isabel's drawings, because they're very detailed and particular.
He has lots of adventures. He's swallowed by a whale at one point, isn't he? And then he's rescued by a giant-slaying, poisoned, sausage-making old woman.
Yes.
So it's a bit like sausage-making old woman.
It's a bit like the Grimm's fairy tales.
I definitely was influenced a lot by fairy tales. There's a lot of influences in the book. I've stolen stories from everywhere, I think it's fair to say.
Tell us about your background. How did you come into graphic fiction?
I did a degree in illustration at the University of Brighton, which was great. I had a really amazing time there. And then after I graduated, I did a short comic for an anthology published by Nobrow, a 7-page comic. And it actually featured the gods that are in that book. And it kind of got me back into comics because I'd been really into them for a while, but I'd sort of focused more on illustration while I was on my degree. And when I finished that story, I realised, I want to get back to doing more comics.
You've come up through a sort of classic art school route. But Emily, the winner of this year, is much older, isn't she?
Yes,
and she's had a much more checkered route to publication.
Yes, she's she did an English degree at Cambridge, and then she just started drawing after that. And I think what it shows is that there is something about the world of comics that's very open. I mean, many of the people who've won the prize in the past are like Isabel and have been at art school. We get loads of entries from Wimbledon College of Art, and we can slightly recognise them now because they have something in common. But the great thing about comics is that it's also a place for enthusiasts and for enthusiasm. So you can come to it late on. And Emily just started going to drawing classes at the Prince of Wales's school in Shoreditch. And, you know, she actually was a runner-up a few years previously. And she said to me, you know, when I was a runner-up, I couldn't draw at all. I used to take photographs of arms and legs and then just try and copy them. So she's sort of self-taught in a way. And that's why her story has a very different feel to Isabel's. But that's what I relish about it. You can be an outsider or you can be an insider. And that's what's so great about it. It's kind of democratic.
But also, Emily's writing non-fiction, isn't she? Whereas Isabel's writing fiction. So this the growth of the graphic memoir interests me. It seems to be a separate strand.
I mean, it's a really good place to put a memoir, I think. I mean, Emily is hoping to turn her story of, you know, suffering from ME and recovering from it into a book. This year, some of the best books I've seen have been memoirs. Also out this month is Katie Green's book, Lighter Than My Shadow, which is about her battle with anorexia and abuse, which makes it sound very grim, but actually it's not. It's a hugely cheering and beautiful book. I mean, I don't know why a comic is any better than, you know, prose for memoir. But maybe there's something about distance. If you're drawing yourself, it helps you to put a bit of distance between you and something quite painful that's happened to you. But I don't know, but the some of the best ones are definitely memoirs, you're right.
Three of the previous winners have been published now.
I know.
That's quite a good hit rate, isn't it, from a short?
Yes, and at least one runner-up has been published as well, and that's Geoff Winterhart, whose book Days of the Bagnold Summer was shortlisted for the Costa Novel Prize. So we have a really good success rate if you're... criteria for success is publication, which I think it has to be, really. I mean, I feel incredibly proud of that because it's so exciting. You sort of discover someone and then they go on to do great things. You know, when Isabel's book arrived, I just thought, hooray! Yeah, I do feel really proud of that. All the judges do. It has had one bad side effect, actually, which is that I think the standard is so high that people are intimidated. We had slightly fewer entries this year, and I have to really talk firmly to the runners-up and say, come on, you can win this.
I was a runner-up.
Yes, you were.
Yeah, when the story was still 2 pages.
Yes, because when we started, we only did 2 pages. But we've extended it now and it's over 4 pages, which in some ways makes it easier and in some ways makes it harder.
Isabel, do you feel that you're part of a community of writers, of graphic novelists?
I think the comic scene in the UK is really brilliant. It's very friendly, welcoming. Yeah, definitely.
You use the word comics. I'm always being told off. We never know what to call it from my side of the literary fence, whether to call them graphic novels or comics.
I say comics.
And you see yourself as part of a continuum with what we would have thought of as comics.
Yeah, do you? Definitely. I think I think it's fair to say I do comics. I suppose it is a graphic novel in that it's very long. So it's a long comic, but it's definitely a comic.
I take turns. I call them graphic novel 1 minute and comics the next. I can see both sides of it. I mean, graphic novel sounds a bit pompous in some ways. And comics, it sounds more honest. But on the other hand, because we are still trying to change people's perceptions of what comics can do, for those people who are still sort of suspicious and sceptical, graphic novel makes them think, there might be something in this for me, people that are a bit more literary. Because it's just that we have, in this country, have a slightly silly view of comics.
But in France, they're called bande dessinée, aren't they? Which is, it's much more serious title.
Yes.
It's got a gravity to it. Whereas comic makes you think it's just going to be all silly laughs, which, you know, here we're dealing with colonic irrigation, please.
Yeah, I know. Well, the French, we're catching up with the French. I mean, you know, last weekend there was the first sort of graphic comics festival in Kendal. I know Isabel was there and I was supposed to be there too. I was ill. And that, you know, is an attempt to do what they do in France, where they have this huge festival called Angoulême, which is an enormous event, isn't it? I think it lasts a week. And it's full of all the, you know, and it's taken very, very seriously in France in a way that it isn't here. So we're catching up. But, you know, the mere idea that we're now having a festival, albeit only for a weekend, that shows that we're starting to win the battle, really. And I, you know, not to be a big head about it, but I think that the Observer Prize has done a lot, really, to push it on. Because, you know, in the beginning, we were the only newspaper that was really reviewing comic books. And now I've noticed the other newspapers, you know, doing the odd one, the odd two. You know, we do one every month. And I wish we could do more, really. And we always do a Christmas roundup. So I think we've done a lot to change perceptions, but there's still a long way to go.
Isabel, what was it like in Kendal?
It was a really good festival. It was the whole town was very welcoming. It was really great.
This is a little town in the Lake District in the north of England, for those international listeners who don't know about it. I mean, it's quite extraordinary to see such a sort of up-and-coming art form descending on somewhere that's just sort of small and associated with Wordsworth.
But there's more and more comic festivals popping up. There's existing ones that are getting bigger and bigger. So there's Thought Bubble in Leeds is a really big one.
And they had amazing people in Kendal. They had Joe Sacco.
Yeah, Posy Simmons,
Brian Talbot.
I met Posy Simmons. It was very exciting.
It was a really good programme, wasn't it? And also you could watch artists draw and there were events for children. And I mean, I thought it was fantastically well organised.
What is the advantage for you of meeting other illustrators? Is it usually a lonely profession?
Yeah, because you're working by yourself in your room all the time, and often like days will go by and I'll only find myself talking to the cat. So it is going to comic conventions and events like Kendall and things like that are really great, because you actually get to meet other people who are doing the same thing as you and talk about process and just what's going on. It's great.
Well, thank you both very much for coming in. Let's now turn to another previous winner, Stephen Collins, who Richard Lee spoke to in Edinburgh about his new graphic novel or comic, The Gigantic Beard That Was Evil.
People familiar with your wry comics in Guardian's Weekend magazine might be surprised to find you publishing a graphic novel. Did you have to put on a serious face while you were drawing it?
I do weird things with my face, actually. When you're drawing someone, you kind of end up doing what you imagine their emotions to be. And I do find myself kind of making very strange faces a lot of the time when I'm drawing. But in terms of actually kind of shifting gear, I do write in a fairly sort of serious way. And I sort of have to make an effort to come up with jokes, I think, most of the time. Most of my influences are things like Alan Bennett, where you got the humour comes as part of a more serious sort of approach. It's like Ian McEwan sort of describes it as comic novels as trying to sort of tickle you to the ground. And I didn't want that too much. If I stuffed it with as many gags to panel ratio as I do in The Guardian, which is about 1 to 6 or more, it would have been unbearable.
But it wasn't too hard to get that depressing. There's a kind of serious question buried in there somewhere about whether comics are slightly more relaxed about shifting between genres.
Yeah, I think so. I think comics are quite uptight about being pigeonholed as superhero stuff. Whenever you get an article about comics, it's usually, it's not all biff, bang, pow, you know. And I've been reading articles like that since I was a teenager, so sort of early 90s, really. It's a very versatile format. It's probably the most versatile art form, really. You can do almost anything with it. You can have a voiceover, a narrator, without it looking too forced. You can show what people are thinking, but also what they're doing. You can just have action. You can have fight scenes. You can have sex scenes, although I've never drawn one, which just, you know, communicate it in the same way as a film does, and you don't have to have loads of awkward description of this goes in there and all that sort of thing. So it's very, very versatile.
When you won the Observer Award in 2010, the Observer Cape Graphic Short Story Award for In Room 208, you said you were working on a longer graphic story. Is that the beard? Is that it?
That was that. The one that I was working on then was one that I am working on now. Not that it's continued, but I abandoned it and then went on to the beard book. I feel like a lot more practiced at doing the longer format now. The first 20 pages were very much kind of, there's a lot of plastic surgery on that, and then after that it got a lot easier. So it's just me sort of learning how, my process was a bit back and forth and learning how to do a longer story. But unlike a novel, you do have to worry about exact room layouts and what the wallpaper in the lounge looks like compared to the hallway and things like that. And that actually matters, because then you end up with continuity errors.
But, I mean, are there notepads kind of full of grids and sort of plans about the story arc?
There are files full of that. I do all my planning on computer because it's much easier in Photoshop to move stuff around.
It's also all in black and white or shades of grey with the pencil. What was the thinking there?
I wanted the tone to be quite dark. It was a joke title at first, and it was a fairly jokey concept that started out as a joke, but my main idea was, could I clunk that onto a fairly sort of depressing meditation on chaos, death, stuff going wrong and uncontrollable mess that comes at you in life sometimes. But I wanted to do one of those kind of jokey little books that you see at the... It wasn't a little book at all, but you see things like Little Book of Moustaches, and I sort of wanted to trick people into thinking it was really cheerful and light, and then whack them with... I like stuff that does that, to be honest.
Dave is stranded on the spookily neat island of Here, and he's surrounded by the unknowable there. He takes the bus to work, he analyses screeds of mysterious data, and then returns home to sit by his front window and draw until he's overwhelmed by the there-ness and his gigantic beard starts to grow. Was that where the story started, with the idea of a man overwhelmed by his facial hair?
Yeah, yeah. My wife said, oh, why don't you just, I don't know, draw a book about somebody that grows a massive beard. And it seems like quite a catchy idea and quite a fun idea. And in my typical way, I tried to turn a joke into something depressing. I hadn't seen it really done before, because beards are this strange sort of thing that seem to sort of come from inside men, and therefore they kind of are associated with animality and that sort of thing. But actually, they're just this kind of, you know, they're like all hair on the body and all things bodily. They could just kind of assail you when you're in your teens, and they just come out of nowhere and you're part of this big longer story, which is, you know, just happening to you. And the story is more about how people rationalize this random thing that just comes out of nowhere and turn it into their own stories and basically tidy him away in the process. And I thought that was a sort of interesting angle to take on it. The actual fact of the beard just is quite a bonus, really, because it makes it quite a jolly and catchy thing to just pick up and start reading.
I noticed that you're actually wearing a beard yourself.
Yeah, keeping it down a bit of late because I don't want people to think I'm some kind of weird autobiographical beard fetishist. It's not about my own face, but I was noticing that a lot of beards were around at the time I started writing it. And funnily enough, they still are. I was kind of vaguely worried that it would look like I'd done a book about, you know, bell-bottom flares or something, and you know, they'd gone out of fashion by the time. But beards are still around in force, which I'm surprised about.
I was wondering how you control the rhyme. I mean, because you start off in sort of basically a rhyming scheme, and then it breaks down a little bit, then it comes back again. Do you copy out the text and look at just the text, or is it just something you do more as you're going?
Yeah, I wrote it as a long form attempt at a poem. I'm not a poet, as you can probably tell, but I thought it'd be interesting to do the narrative almost entirely as a poem. I was just sort of challenging myself to see if I could turn dialogue into rhyme without it getting too doggerelish. I wanted all the sound effects to be rhymed and part of the flow of the narrative as well. Because I just hadn't seen that done anywhere else, and I just wanted to see if it worked.
I want to say the word incantatory.
Yeah, exactly. Because he's in a very miserably samey sort of place, and it allows for a lot of repetition. And the idea generally was that it allowed a sort of slightly childlike quality to it at the beginning, and then I wanted to sort of sneak in some slightly more disturbing ideas.
You're not afraid of pushing the story on beyond realism? I mean, a beard that grows so fast it blunts scissors, ensnares gawpers and soon requires scaffolding. It even seems to tear narrative to shreds. Do comics have a natural affinity with the surreal?
You can muck about with things so much. I mean, if the book's about anything, it's about framing. It's about the way people frame the world and reality, and by the process of doing that, by putting something in a frame, which we all do, whether it's a kind of a narrative or a story or a way of understanding the world or a viewpoint. By doing that, you necessarily cut out loads of other stuff. You cut out everything else that isn't within your own sort of picture. That kind of framing process allows you to do pretty much anything. You can do quite surreal things and muck about with time. You can have time going backwards, or you can make time turn palindromic, if you like. And you can do lots of structurally interesting and surreal things, which maybe wouldn't work in a film or a novel so much.
So, the Observer Cape Comica Prize for graphic novels has been done and dusted for another year. But it's not the end of the year for us. We have another prize-giving brewing. Next week, we publish the shortlist for the Guardian First Book Award. Before the longlist was even announced, we met up with Hannah Kent, longlisted for her debut novel, Burial Rites, and sensed there was something just a little bit special about her. Not least because she's an Australian who has set her first historical thriller in Iceland.
I actually lived in Iceland when I was 17 years old. I finished high school in Australia, and before I settled down to study, I thought I'd go off on an adventure, and I applied for a Rotary exchange, and they ended up sending me to Iceland, actually to a very small fishing village in the north of the country, so I wasn't even in Reykjavik.
And there you found this extraordinary story of the last woman to be executed. Was it the last person to be executed in Iceland?
Yes, the last person. It was this woman. The first few months of my exchange were quite difficult for me. I'd left a 40-plus degree summer heatwave in Adelaide in Australia and then gone over to Iceland in the middle of a January winter. And I was very homesick. I didn't speak the language. And I was in this sort of quite a strange headspace when I first heard this story. And what happened is I'd gone to the south, to the capital, with my host parents at the time. And we were on the way back when we drove through this extraordinary tract of landscape. It's these long sweeping valleys with mountain ranges in between. And we came to this area where it looked like the earth had suddenly erupted into a rash of pimples. Hundreds and hundreds of these tiny little hills all out of nowhere. And I was so sort of surprised by it and in awe of it that I asked them if it was significant for any reason. And they said, you know, the hills had been caused by an avalanche some years ago, but that it was interesting. I mentioned the place because it was the site of the last execution in Iceland. And I was immediately intrigued, as I think anyone would be, on hearing a story like that or the promise of a story. And I pushed them for more details, and then they told me that it had been a woman called Agnes, who was a servant and who had been beheaded for her role in the very gruesome murder of two men way back in 1830. So that was really the first time I heard it. And I think there was probably a great deal to do with the emotional experience I was going through at the time, as being the outsider in a small town, feeling very conspicuous, but at the same time incredibly socially isolated, that the story of this woman who would have been a similar outsider or would have gone, you know, through to some extent a similar experience really resonated with me.
And while Agnes, her name's Agnes Magnusdotter, which presumably means Magnus's daughter, does it?
It does, yeah, Magnus's daughter, yeah.
She's held in detention in a family home. And she sort of develops a sort of Stockholm syndrome, doesn't she? She gets very attached to the people that she's staying with.
This is something I was really interested in. I mean, the book starts after the crime has taken place, and in fact, after she's already been sentenced. And it basically, you know, starts with her being moved to this very small farmhouse where she's to be, you know, detained. And the reason for that is there's no jails, there's no sort of public facilities that she could be held in. So she's sent to the family of a district officer. And, you know, as someone who had been researching 19th century Iceland for some time, I was really curious as to how people lived. They all slept in the one room, for instance. They lived in very small turf houses. And I was thinking, you know, how extraordinary to have a family who probably would have been hostile, I think, to a murderess or to a convicted criminal, and very, I guess, repulsed by the idea of having to, you know, have her live with them and sleep in the same room. But then also you place that alongside the notion of, if you spend any length of time with anyone, no matter what you think of them, I think inevitably there's some sort of shared understanding that is created. And that's really what I wanted to explore with the family and with Agnes. So as much as she is distrustful of them, because I think by this stage in, you know, her life, she knows that she can't trust anyone, so she's not going to open herself up to them. And they obviously don't want to have anything to do with her. But then they're working alongside one another. They're living in the very same small area. Inevitably, they're going to start reaching out to one another and talking to one another, even if that's still a complicated and complex relationship.
You mentioned research, and part of this novel's strength is the extraordinary ability you have to conjure what it was like to be in Iceland in the 19th century. Tell us how you went about constructing that mood. How much of it was to do with research, and how much of it is to do with just going into your own imagination?
Well, I was familiar with certain aspects of life in Iceland from living there and visiting several times after my initial exchange. But I knew that I would have to go back and research every single aspect, you know, the cultural life, the social life, the political life of this particular time, to make it seem realistic. But also, I think, to explore the external circumstances that it might have led to Agnes ultimately being in this very sad and sorrowful circumstance. And so I spent about 2 years doing the research for this book. And because I was in Adelaide in Australia and didn't necessarily have a great wealth of information on Iceland, you know, particularly about the murders and so on and the execution to hand, I spent a lot of time just reading novels set in Iceland, the works of Halldór Laxness. I read the sagas. I found, you know, very dry, dull academic papers on things from, you know, Nordic sheep grazing from 1730 to, you know, 1900s, to smallpox epidemics, to recipes on, you know, how you make porridge out of moss and all these sorts of things. And I was kind of indiscriminate. And after about 2 years, I had read so much about Iceland in that particular time that I've felt saturated with the knowledge and I could just write out of that quite generally.
You won a prize for the first draft of this novel, and then you went on to get a huge two-book deal, massive two-book deal, in seven figures, I believe.
We've never confirmed or denied anything. It was certainly significant, and there was an auction. It was very exciting.
How does it feel to you to suddenly have arrived? Do you feel daunted by it?
It's just surreal. I mean, I'm incredibly happy and very grateful to my amazing publishers who from very early on believed in the book and saw something in it that they thought would others would be able to engage with. You know, I've always wanted to be a writer ever since I, you know, could read. And my long-standing goal for many years during my teenage years was to be published before I was 30 years of age. So to me, actually, that's the most thrilling aspect of everything that has happened, is just actually having a book in print.
How old are you?
I'm 28 now.
You made it.
I made it.
Congratulations.
Thank you.
Hannah Kent there. She's one of 11 authors who will be hoping for a place on the Guardian First Book Awards shortlist next week. The winner will be announced on November the 28th. And that's it from us for this week. From me, Claire Armistead, and from my producer, Tim Mabey, goodbye.
Support for this Guardian podcast comes from Squarespace, providing creative tools that help you bring your ideas to life. Squarespace offers free domain names, customizable designs, drag and drop tools, and 24/7 support. Squarespace also offers seamless e-commerce solutions for you or your small business. Every design automatically includes a unique mobile experience that matches the overall style of your website, so your content will look brilliant on any device. Start your free trial today, no credit card required. As a Guardian podcast listener, you'll get 10% off your new account by using the offer code Guardian.
For more great downloads, go to theguardian.com/audio.